Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps, and today we're going back to Latin class.
Ferret. In Latin, amabat.
I hope you have a really good memory. Because there is a lot to remember. There is hic, haec, hoc. There are all those declensions and cases. There is like nominative, genitive, dative, accusative. It kind of just goes on and on.
Memorizing everything, like all of this stuff. Memorizing like 50 terms that all mean this.
That's a lot of work for a language nobody actually speaks anymore. So why bother?
My roommates ask me that a lot. I mean, it's kind of like a puzzle. Like, I don't know, yeah, it's kind of fun.
What's our accusative singular going to be?
Quad.
Good. So quad and then our plural?
Today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're not actually going to try to teach you Latin. But we are going to make the case that the ancient Roman Empire is in some ways more relevant than ever. Not because of the grammar, but because the big, hot-button debates that occupy the political stage today, state security, civil liberties, terrorism, those exact same issues obsessed the ancient Romans.
What the Romans are doing is they are living in a big city. It's a million people. It's a state which has already got a large empire, and they are facing up to the issues of how you run that empire, how you guarantee the liberty of the individual, what it means to be a citizen. And they have some of the most enlightening ways of talking about that there are, even if we don't actually want to copy them.
This is Mary Beard. She's probably the most famous living classicist. She's a Cambridge don who's a familiar figure in England on TV and radio. And her newest project is a giant history of the Roman Empire. It's called SPQR, the abbreviation for the Senate and the Roman People. And it begins with one of the most famous episodes in Roman history. 63 AD, Marcus Tullius Cicero, the renowned philosopher and orator, has been elected consul of Rome when he uncovers just what the FBI is always warning us about.
Cicero discovers, or claims to have discovered, a terrorist plot to overthrow the state, led by, in Cicero's view, a drunken gambling renegade aristocrat called Catiline. And Cicero collects intelligence, he intercepts letters, and eventually he faces Catiline down in the Senate and says, "You're wanting to destroy the state, get out." What happens then is that Cicero rounds up the people he believed to be Catiline's accomplices, and he executes them without trial, even though they were Roman citizens.
Was this normal?
One of the absolute foundations of Roman citizenship was the right to a fair trial. Mm. So this was flouting that basic civil liberty.
So this is even worse than disappearing somebody to a black site.
Yes, but it's on the spectrum. It's on the same spectrum. But to start with, Cicero is hailed and everybody's delighted. The plot has been overthrown. But shortly, doubts start to emerge about the legality of it. And within a couple of years, Cicero finds himself in exile on the charge of having put Roman citizens to death without trial. Mm. And it's, for me, a wonderful moment of a kind of puzzle and conflict that we still face, which is how far is it legitimate to suspend civil liberties in order to protect the state from plot or terrorism? And I think what's kind of moving about it in a way is that the Romans didn't get that sorted out. They were as puzzled as we are. We don't know. You know, when the British government decides to eradicate, that's another kind of horrible euphemism, eradicate a British citizen fighting in Syria for so-called ISIS, mm-hmm. we still have debates about whether that was a legitimate thing to do. And I think anybody who thinks that they've got it sorted is kidding themselves.
The thing is, we don't often debate them with reference to what happened in ancient Rome, and perhaps we should. Are there lessons to be learned, or is that too simplistic?
I think in some ways it, it's a bit simplistic. I mean, I think people are always wanting, or classicists like me are always wanting to show that there are real lessons to be learned from the Romans. They're never quite as simple as people would like to make out. We're living in a very, very different world. But I think what there is in Roman history, it's a kind of consciousness-raising device. You know, as we read Cicero, as we think about the conundrums and the puzzles that they faced, we can learn to think about our own difficulties and conflicts, I think, rather more deeply. I mean, it's true, we don't usually refer to Cicero when we talk about issues of terrorism. It is still striking to me that the very first words of Cicero's first speech, in which he denounced Catiline, quousque tandem, how long, Catiline, will you go on abusing our patience? Those words are still used in political debate.
Wait, really?
Ted Cruz used them to attack Obama.
One of the things that they dealt with, grappled with so much in the Roman Empire, which is such a contemporary issue for us too, it seems to me, is issues about power and the limits of power. You know, the fact that we even have conversations today about tyranny, about dictators. I mean, in some ways, didn't that conversation begin with the ancient Romans?
Yes, and you know, the assassination of Julius Caesar, who made himself notoriously dictator for life, and dictator's a Roman word, is the most famous political assassination of all time. You know, that in a sense the model of political killing.
We know that story from Shakespeare, of course, which is probably the version most of us sort of have in the back of our minds, but what actually happened?
Well, it was much even messier than the way Shakespeare tells it. You got a group of dissidents, actually friends of Caesar, Brutus and Cassius, who become the lead players in Shakespeare's play. They claim to feel that the power of Caesar has got so great that the only way out, even though they are his friends, the only way out is to kill him. Now, actually, what is always rather unsettling about the murder of Caesar is that they succeed in their aim of getting rid of the dictator. But what happens is that there's a period of, well, more than 10 years of civil war. And the outcome of that is one-man rule established in Rome permanently. So right. They get rid of the dictator, but they don't destroy that kind of autocracy that they had in their sights.
Mm. They get, in fact, more of what they wanted to get rid of. But did they debate much about the assassination of Julius Caesar, whether, you know, were they asking themselves the question, can assassination be ethical?
Yes, and it looks pretty clear, and again, this comes out in Shakespeare, it looks pretty clear that a lot of the people of Rome also felt that Caesar had been wrongly killed. Mm. Now, whether they felt he'd been wrongly killed because they actually supported what he was doing, because he was a pretty populist dictator, or because actually assassination was not the way of solving problems, we don't really know, but there's a lot of people on Caesar's side in the immediate aftermath.
And the assassination was very public, right?
Yeah, it was in the Senate House, and it was also very messy. I think we tend to forget that assassinations, well, they're often messy even now, but they were particularly so in the ancient world. You know, you can't take a sniper shot from, you know, 50 foot away. You have to get up close with your daggers, and, you know, it's bloody. It's very bloody.
So did they all just basically hack him to pieces?
They hacked him to pieces, and of course, also, as always happens, some people got caught in the friendly fire because, you know, it was a messy business, and some of the assassins ended up wounding fellow assassins, not Caesar.
Oh, and you point out in the book also the famous line, et tu, Brutus?
Yes.
That's not actually what he said?
No, sadly. I mean, that's a Shakespearean invention, I think. What he said, and he said it in Greek, probably looking at Brutus, though we don't know, he said, kai sou technon, which means, you too, my son. You know, are you involved in this too, my child? And there's been
even more heartbreaking.
Yes. And there's been a whole lot of debate about exactly what he meant by child or son, technon, because some people in the ancient world, as much as in the modern world, have thought that, in fact, Brutus, the assassin, was the illegitimate son of Julius Caesar.
Oh, not just his protege, actually yes, his son.
And it could mean either.
How much of the Roman Empire's fall can we blame on corruption, internal rot, and, you know, tyranny run amok?
Well, that's always been the big question. You know, back to Gibbon, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And there have been any number of solutions, some of them mad and some of them quite sensible. You know, was it corruption? Was it inflation? Was it barbarian invasion? You know, was it too much sex? Was it lead in the water pipes? You know, on and on. Actually, no one's ever nailed it. I think the one thing that we do have to recognise, though, is that the traditional picture we have of civilised Rome with all its culture, etc., and by that stage it was Christian, being taken over by nasty barbarians, for whatever reason, who destroyed the great wonders of the classical world, you know, Attila, the Hun, and the Vandals. We still use the name Vandal to mean, you know, a perfectly decent group of people, but has become to be our name for wanton destruction. Now, that is simply not what happened. And almost all these barbarians who apparently destroyed classical culture, they were mostly Christians, just like the Romans by that stage. And what they really created was a whole series of mini Romes where they developed the ideas of Roman law, where they wrote Latin poetry. They were still using and adapting and adopting classical Roman culture.
Well, that's fascinating because, of course, we do tend to, I'm sitting here in a contemporary empire today, the United States of America, and, you know, I think everything after 9/11 changed a lot, and there's this kind of pervasive feeling that perhaps we are seeing the beginning of the end of the American empire, and Rome and that story of the fall of Rome and the Vandals and the Dark Ages exists as a kind of cautionary tale, you know, oh, be careful, this might happen to us too. So it's fascinating to hear you say, well, maybe it was actually not at all so bad.
It wasn't as bad. I mean, there's big debates about this, but I think, first of all, it's transformation more than fall. And what the Romans would have said, I think, to the American question is they would have said, look, there's actually a kind of strange natural life cycle of empires. You know, every empire rises and eventually it falls. And there's no way out of that. And there's a very poignant story, really, of when one of Rome's most kind of vicious and successful conquerors, a man called Scipio, had just destroyed Rome's great enemy, Carthage, and he'd put the city to fire. He was standing there watching the flames of that once great city in complete victory. And the guy standing beside him, whose account of this we have, notices that he's crying. And so he says, Scipio, why are you crying? And Scipio quotes a line of the great Greek poet Homer from Homer's account of the destruction of Troy. He replies basically to the effect of, that's going to happen to Rome too one day, you know.
That's Mary Beard. She's a professor of classics at Cambridge University. And we were talking about her new book, SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Hi, I'm Tony Grafton. I teach European history at Princeton, and I'm here to tell you that Latin can save your life. I didn't always know or believe this, but in the last few years, I found that my students at Princeton were doing work of a quality and a scale that I'd never seen before. And the reason I realized this was I was found I had to get up at 4 a.m. in order just to keep up with what they were doing. And I began to wonder how this was possible. What was igniting these students? What I discovered was that most of them had gone to a summer institute in Rome where they learned to speak Latin. The method was founded by an American priest who used to write Latin documents for the Pope. He was a grumpy, wonderful man who invited anyone who wanted to come study Latin with him in the summer and taught you not how to translate Latin. He hated that. He thought it was stupid that people could take 10 years of Latin and would only be able to translate 30 lines. He would say, every bum and prostitute in the ancient city of Rome could speak Latin, and you're going to do that too, and then you'll really be able to read it. And he would yell at people. He spoke sharply at them, he needled them, and they loved him. And by the end of those summers, they could do it. They could speak Latin. They could hear the music and the poetry. They could hear the scorn and the satires. Well, a number of young scholars have taken this up. They've built a bit of an endowment with scholarships so they can take kids who can't afford it. They bring these students to Rome, and for a month, they march them around. They read Latin books in the places they're about. They read about gladiators in the Colosseum. They have classes where students are constantly challenged, not just to translate, but to make Latin their own, to talk about Latin in Latin. They sing Latin. They rap Latin. It makes them inspired students. It gives them vocations they want to teach. These students are seeing themselves as chosen to keep Latin alive. And others find inspiration in this to do things like, in one case, building a tutoring program for third graders in Bushwick to get them off the streets, which aren't safe, and have them reading Latin. In an age when the humanities are full of despair, when studies that don't seem to bring any profit are despised, there's something about this which I don't yet understand, but I'm here to say it's the most hopeful thing I've seen in the humanities in about 20 years, and it works. I have seen the future, said Lincoln Steffens when he went to Soviet Russia, and it works. Well, he was wrong, but I have seen the past, and it does work.
How Latin Can Save Your Life, a dangerous idea from Princeton historian Tony Grafton. Coming up, empires crumble, civilizations collapse. What's that line? Those who don't learn their history are condemned to repeat it? Lessons from the Bronze Age after this. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. If you try to imagine what the ancient world looked like, what comes to mind? Gladiators in the Colosseum? Roman emperors reclining in togas, being fed flamingo tongues? Or maybe something more along the lines of Monty Python's Life of Brian. But you might be surprised to learn that there was a sophisticated culture 1,000 years before all of that, stretching from Egypt to Babylon, a globalized world of trade and diplomacy. And that world, known as the Late Bronze Age, is what archaeologist Eric Klein studies. He says we would be amazed by how contemporary it feels. And also that we're now facing some of the same challenges they faced, which led to their ruin. Klein recently stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson.
Eric, you've done something rather audacious. You've come up with an actual date for when civilization collapsed in the ancient world, 1177 BC. What happened then?
Well, in 1177 BC, most of the known world in the Aegean and the Eastern Mediterranean collapsed, came to an end. It was the 8th year of Ramses III, the pharaoh of Egypt. But I do have to say that that's just a shorthand for the overall collapse. Just like we say 476 is when the Roman Empire collapsed, and we know it actually took about 100 years. Same thing here.
And you're talking about the collapse of what we've come to know as the Bronze Age.
As the Late Bronze Age, absolutely. So when we talk about the collapse of civilizations, we're talking Mycenaeans and Minoans from Greece. We're talking about the Hittites in Turkey, Cypriots in Cyprus, Canaanites in what is now Israel, Lebanon, Syria, Assyria and Babylon in what is now Iran and Iraq. We've got about 8 or 9 civilizations that are all interacting and they all go down at the same time, like a set of dominoes. Mm.
And to put this in perspective, the Bronze Age flourished for nearly 2,000 years across this vast expanse of land.
Right.
You say there was a global economy going on here.
There was. Now, you know, put that into context, it's not global like us today, but it was global for their time, I would say, from Italy on the west to basically Iran or Afghanistan in the east, and then Turkey in the north down to Egypt in the south. They are globalized. They are all interconnected. Most people are surprised at how sophisticated they were, especially in terms of, say, the trade networks. And we've got one written text that talks about a pair of Minoan shoes, leather shoes, probably sandals, that were sent all the way from Crete to Hammurabi in Babylon. You know, the famous lawgiver, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, back in about 1800 BC. And yet the shoes, they say, were returned. Now,
they weren't liked, so they were sent back.
Yeah, are they too small? Were they last millennium? I mean, I don't know. Oh. But again, you know, there are the parallels to today where you're like, wait, that happens today all the time.
So what happened then in 1177 BC?
Well, we've got a group that comes through actually twice, in 1207 and in 1177, which archaeologists and historians have called the Sea Peoples. I don't think that they're completely the reason for the collapse. I don't think that invasions are enough. You can survive those. But certainly they've been the kind of the bogeyman for more than a century now. So what I wanted to do was to take a look at exactly what could have caused the collapse of civilizations.
So there were a range of factors, but there were these people who actually did invade. They invaded Egypt, right? And there was a big battle with Ramses III?
Absolutely. There's not only a battle, there's two battles. There's a land battle and a sea battle. In both cases, the Egyptians win. They probably actually ambushed them. But it's a Pyrrhic victory. They are weakened so much that they're never the same again. Now, this is the New Kingdom period. So King Tut, for example, this is his time period. Hatshepsut, Akhenaten, I mean, Ramses II. All these people are living in this, say, last 300 years. So when it goes down, it really goes down. But I don't think the Sea Peoples are totally responsible. In fact, I think they're as much victims as they are oppressors. So yes, they're coming in, but they're not Vikings. They're not raiders. They're migrants. They're coming with their families. We see a picture of them that Ramses leaves us with an ox cart with the women and the children, the belongings there. So I think a better analogy, not Vikings. It's more like the Dust Bowl of the 1930s with people leaving Oklahoma and going to California. That's what we're looking at. And in fact, that's where we've got a parallel. Today's Sea Peoples, we've actually got a choice. Are they the refugees that are flooding Europe, leaving the crisis in Syria? Or are they like ISIS that's busy destroying the culture in the Near East? You know, which ones are they? Are they the oppressors or are they the victims? And one could say that our version of the Sea Peoples is actually both.
And you say there were other factors that led to this collapse of civilization as well, lots of environmental factors.
I do, because I think, you know, we are resilient, and so we've survived invasions. We've survived things like climate change. In fact, there is drought at that time. We now have the scientific evidence from North Syria and Cyprus and Israel and Greece that they are trying to survive a drought that lasted 150 to 300 years.
So you're saying there was climate change back then as
Absolutely,
well?
Absolutely, there's climate change, though it's not like the Hittites had SUVs back then. This is Mother Nature doing climate change, but there definitely is. And then the written texts from the period talk about famines. They talk about people dying. But we also have things like earthquakes. In fact, you know, modern seismologists talk about an earthquake sequence where if you have an earthquake on a fault line, like the North Anatolian fault line that goes across Turkey, if you have an earthquake and it doesn't release the pressure completely, you'll have another earthquake right next to it, right nearby, either days later, weeks later, a year later. And if that one doesn't release the rest of the pressure, you'll have another one and another one. So you've got to factor in earthquakes as well. And that's where I think we've got a perfect storm because, you know, if you have a drought, some of you are going to survive it. If you've got famine, some will survive. If you have invaders, some will survive. If you have earthquakes, some will. What if you have them all? What if one and then another and then another and then another and you've got a perfect storm?
So a lot of the things that you've mentioned suggest possible modern parallels. You know, the climate issues, obviously turmoil politically in today's world.
Right.
I don't know about the earthquakes yet.
No, but we do, actually.
We do.
We do.
Yeah. But don't we always have these issues? I mean, sort of throughout history. I mean, the question is, are there enough that cluster together that actually cause collapse?
Well, that's the big question. And so how many other times in history have we had these clusters of unfortunate events, shall we say? I think we've probably had them quite often, but in most cases, there are mitigating factors that have stopped the collapse. We are now advanced enough to realize this. So what would we do to stop this, right? You know, I would say, for instance, one thing is to basically stop denying there's climate change and to do something about it. We can have control over some of the things. And I would say one of the examples would be in 2008 when Wall Street started melting down and people stepped in to fix it. Had they not stepped in and it kept going, well, the head of the World Bank at the time said we were that close to a global financial crisis. So when you have a complex system, it only takes a little bit and it throws the whole thing out of whack. And so actually, I think that's why the parallel to today is even bigger than one might expect. Because usually when you're talking about a collapse, it's you know one entity. It's the Mayas going down, mm-hmm. or it's the Roman Empire. In this particular case, back in 1177, you have intertwined civilizations that all go down.
Which, of course, is what we have today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So this is a case where history does have some things that it could teach us if we want to listen and learn. And I think this is one where one of my colleagues, Carol Bell in England, made the analogy. She said, you know, tin for them back then, they needed tin to make bronze. That's the same situation as us needing oil to make gasoline.
I'm wondering if it also, I mean, coming back to our discussion of civilizations collapsing and, you know, might we have collapsed today, whether that might offer some hope as well. I mean, it's sort of like there's always something that comes and replaces the thing that fell apart.
Absolutely. There's always a phoenix that rises from the ashes. And in fact, in the book, I end with saying, you know what? Yes, this was terrible for them. And yes, we lost a lot when the late Bronze Age all collapsed. But you know what? Out of the ashes, after the Dark Ages are over, we get all kinds of new things. I mean, in part because of the power vacuum that's caused by the collapse, we get the Israelites moving in and we get, you know, monotheism. And in Greece, a couple centuries later, we get democracy. So, you know, what if the late Bronze Age hadn't come to an end? Would we have had democracy and all of that? So there is a silver lining, if you want to look for it. And we are the direct descendants of those new things. We've got stuff from the late Bronze Age, of course, already. I mean, Hammurabi's Law Code and this, that, and the other. And even Akhenaten is maybe starting a little type of monotheism. But we are the direct descendants of what happened after the late Bronze Age collapse.
Eric Klein talking with Steve Paulson. Eric's a classicist and archaeologist at George Washington University. And he's the author of 1177 BC, The Year Civilization Collapsed. There are some classical texts that have never really gone out of style. The Bible, of course. Marcus Aurelius' Meditations. Plato's Republic. And 1,000 years from now, will anyone be reading our great authors? English professor Mark Edmondson thinks that there was an idealism in some of those great works that stands as a kind of antidote to the shallowness of our age. In his new book, Self and Soul, he calls for a return to the idealism of the past. He talked with Raymond Tangekar about the value of reading Homer, Plato, and the great sages of the ancient world.
So, Mark, you've written this thoughtful exploration of three ancient ideals, and in it, you kind of make the case that we've lost our way, that, you know, all the luxuries and modern conveniences that we live with have made us self-absorbed, narcissistic, materialistic. Basically, we're more concerned with the self than the soul. How did you come to this conclusion?
Well, through observation and through reading, my two great vehicles for revelation. But I think more and more we have become a self-seeking, a bourgeois society, believing that we can be happy with, you know, acquisition of comforts and position and property and respect and all those things. I think that maybe that's true for some people, but I would like my students to know that there's another way of life, and that way of life pivots around the ideals.
Well, let's tease apart these ideals one by one.
Sure.
The first one that you talk about is courage, which you see best illustrated in the Iliad, and specifically in the examples of Hector and Achilles. So what do they teach us about courage?
Well, Hector is very much like the legendary citizen soldier of America in World War II. And that citizen soldier was very modest, not interested in ridding the world of fascism, not interested in restoring democracy, just wanting to get over there, get the job done, protect his home, and then go home and live a quiet life. After war, he spoke very little, in his ideal form anyway, of what he had achieved there or what he had seen there. But really, those people absolutely saved the world. It looked very dark for a long time. So that old ideal of the citizen soldier seems to be leaving us. And then there's that very rare ideal of the absolutely committed warrior who is never afraid to die, will do anything for his friends and anything for his country and anything for his reputation. And that's Achilles, who wants to be the greatest fighter who ever lives. And that's a much rarer kind of ideal. It occurs not commonly at all. But I think that there are probably fewer people pursuing that ideal, though I can't be sure. And both of these warrior ideals have gone into disrepute with the generally educated classes in our country. I think there's a level of skepticism and then moving on to contempt among many college-educated people for people who are in the armed services. I think that's a mistake.
Are you saying that in order to cultivate this ideal, you have to be a member of the armed services, or could this exist within a non-military context?
I think that the essence of courage is what Hector embodies, the willingness to fight and die for one's country. That doesn't mean there aren't other brave acts to be seen, and we can't talk about somebody as being brave who stands up for a position that's unpopular or writes something that's not well-liked or sticks to his guns in this way or that. But I do think that there's one essential quality that brave people have, and it's the willingness to fight and die to defend one's country.
Well, I can imagine that some people would be hearing you tout the virtue of courage and think, you know, okay, if you take that to its logical conclusion, what you really get is just war without end. I mean, is that really a virtue we should be promoting?
No. The warrior Hector will only fight when he realizes his cause is just. The warrior Achilles will fight, broadly speaking, when his nation says the war is just. But the problem of war is a political problem. It's a problem of our democracy. And if we have Hectors and we have Achilles, we need to be in a position to send them out only into wars about which we feel very full conviction. I think that some of my friends, my progressive friends, believe that there should be no war ever. Mm-hmm. I believe that too. But even Plato, the most humane of all philosophers, I think, said that he could imagine a day when there would perhaps be no war among the Greeks, but he could never imagine a day when there'd be no war, period. And I agree with him, alas.
Well, let's move on to another ideal that you write about. I mean, one that would seem kind of surprising given that we've been talking about this warrior ideal.
Yes.
And that's the ideal of compassion, which you see illustrated right in the examples and teachings of Jesus, Confucius, and the Buddha.
Yes, those are my big three. There's so many great stories in the Gospels and wonderful stories in the Buddhist texts, the Torah, in Confucius as well. But one of the best ones is what's called the miracle of the loaves and fishes, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the standard story is that, you know, a great crowd of people follows Jesus for day after day. They listen to a preach. They pray with him. They become hungry. They become tired. It looks like they are really, really going to have to walk home, maybe not of starvation, but of illness and great pain. And so Jesus collects some bread, and he collects a few fishes, and he blesses them, and it feeds the entire crowd. What a miracle. Well, maybe it was, in fact, a miracle. Maybe it was a divine intervention of some sort. But I suspect that what Jesus and his disciples did was reach in their pockets and pull out what they had. Had a couple of fishes, they had a couple of loaves of bread, and they distributed their last food. And the people who were hanging around with them said, yeah, you know, I do have a little bit in my pouch, too. And out they brought it, and they shared it, and they shared it, and they shared it. And what had been a crowd became a community. And people who had been relative strangers to each other became temporarily brothers and sisters. That's a miracle.
I think few people would deny that, you know, Jesus, Confucius, and the Buddha are great exemplars of compassion. But, I mean, there are modern examples of this, too, right? You know, you have people like Dorothy Day, Martin Luther King Jr., Cesar Chavez. And I'm sure there are countless others like them who we never hear about. So are we really lacking in compassion?
Most of the figures you mentioned are political figures who sought justice. And I have the greatest respect for justice, but I would dare to put compassion a notch above. A compassionate individual is somebody who says, there is no me, there is no you, we are all one. And I think there are such people. I've been teaching at the University of Virginia now for 30 years, and 5 years before that at Yale University. And I love my students. They're smart and lively and decent. But as time has gone on, I have seen fewer of them say, I'm going to live for others. I'm going to protect other people. I'm going to seek knowledge or wisdom. I'm going to be a great artist. I don't care where the money comes from. I've seen less of that. And in the country at large, I've seen more and more people who are interested in feathering their own nests and lying down in them. It's hard to blame them. Look at all the great stuff we got. Big screen TVs, amazing stereos. And these things are inexpensive, in part because they're made in other nations and our working people have no more jobs. But we don't care that much.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to another ideal that you talk about, that of wisdom.
Yeah.
And you use Plato and Emerson as examples.
Mm-hmm.
The question is how to actually achieve that, right? Because as you point out, there's so many distractions. There's family, there's work, and there's all this other noise that keeps us self-absorbed or self-interested. Is it possible to cultivate this kind of contemplative side without completely withdrawing from the world?
You know, you sit down and you read Plato rather than watching another installment of your favorite TV serial, and you begin to try in your own mind to answer some of the questions that he poses. You read as much as you can. You keep a journal. You write essays. You write poems. You write plays. And you do that to find out what you take to be true. I think that's completely possible, though I think that there are any number of assaults against this particular life. And not the least of these assaults comes from the academy, which has been busy dismantling the whole idea of truth for the last 30 years.
Hmm. Well, so it almost sounds like you're also advocating for a shift within education also, within the academy, in approaching these subjects.
Well, I think that the general attitude, if I may be a little over-rapid, toward literary and philosophical texts is that they are to be analyzed, described, and often debunked. But we never ask a simple question of a book by Plato. Is it true or is it not? And unless we take the time to ask that question, is it true or is it not, I think that most humanistic education is going to become a vehicle for the sharpening of a mind that is an acute mind, but one that has no values and no commitment to wisdom whatsoever and is perfectly capable of going off and taking on any job without much compunction.
As I was reading your book, I was just thinking to myself how incongruous this all seems to, you know, modern life. I mean, if someone walked up to me and said that they were going to quit their job and lead a more compassionate life in the same vein as Jesus, I would think they were insane. I mean, it almost sounds delusional.
You are steeped in the ideologies of consumer capitalism. Of course you think so. Do you think Jesus has stayed around for 2,000 years because his message is empty? Consumer capitalism is crap. It's on the way out. But the message of Jesus and Plato and Homer will live forever. These are just little blips on the screen, and they will soon be shown to be the transparently ridiculous things that they are, and we'll need something else.
What you're saying in this book isn't controversial, right? I mean, it's not uncommon to hear someone criticize materialistic culture and advocate a return to the wisdom of the ancients or the classical texts. What's new about your argument, though? I mean, why did you want to write this now, as opposed to just referring back to someone else?
Well, what's new about it is that it's old and is on the verge of being forgotten by most people. You just told me that if someone told you that they were going to go off and follow the teachings of Rabbi Jesus, you would tell them that they were half mad. If that's the way you feel about it, then surely this is an old idea that has lost its power. As Dr. Johnson said, we need to be reminded more than we need to be informed. And I think that's what I'm trying to do. There's nothing original in this book. Nothing. It is simply a revitalization of ideas that are so valuable that it would be truly crushing if they passed out of circulation.
Mark Edmondson teaches English at the University of Virginia. He and Raymond Tongakar were talking about his new book, Self and Soul. So what do you think? Have we forgotten ancient virtues like courage and wisdom? You can share your thoughts on our Facebook page.
Was a real piss and was very rarely stable. I digger was a boozy beggar who could think you under the table. David Hume could outconsume Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, and Wittgenstein was a beery swine who was just as sloshed as Schlegel. There's nothing Nietzsche couldn't teach about the raising of the wrist. Socrates himself was permanently pissed. John Stuart Mill of his own free will, on half by the shandy was particularly ill. Plato, they say, could stick it away. Half grade of whiskey every day. Aristotle was a bugger for the bottle. Hobbes was fond of his dram. And René Descartes was a drunken fart. I drink, therefore I am. Yes, Socrates himself is particularly missed. A lovely little thinker, but a bugger when he's pissed.
So do philosophers have anything to teach us? Coming up, the story of a philosopher who taught Plato to Palestinian students in the Middle East. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Carlos Frankl is a philosopher who decided to see what good philosophy could do in the real world. So he took his Plato and his Maimonides on the road to war zones and poor neighborhoods in places like East Jerusalem and Indonesia and Brazil. He told Steve Paulson that he wound up learning as much as his students did.
Carlos, can you take me back to the beginning of this project when you were living in Cairo working on your PhD? Why did you want to talk about philosophy with some of the Egyptian students you met?
Yeah, right. So the ideas for this book really started taking shape already in early 2000. As you mentioned, I was finishing up back then my PhD dissertation, which was on medieval Hebrew and Arabic philosophical texts. And anyone who has studied Arabic knows that it's a really hard language to learn. And so I went for 3 months to Cairo. And there, I studied with a private teacher, but I also organized a kind of informal language exchange with Egyptian students on the side. And so the better we got to know each other, the more we became friends, and the more we also became concerned about our really strikingly different ways of life. And they, you know, really wanted to convert me to Islam to save my soul from eternally burning in hell. And I wanted to convert them to the secular worldview that I grew up with, because I didn't want them to waste their real life for what I think is the illusion of an afterlife.
So you are an atheist, and you were talking with a bunch of Muslim students.
That's correct. And in one of these discussions, the question came up whether there's something like a proof for God's existence. And I was really surprised by this question, because it's, you know, it's not the kind of question that I get every day, you know, when you're sitting in a bar having a beer in Manhattan or Montreal or Berlin or so. You know, usually you don't talk about proofs about God's existence. And so I said, well, I think there's no proof for God's existence. And of course, they came up with a proof. I pointed out a flaw in their reasoning. They came up with an improved version and so on.
But it sounds like what you realized is that you could talk about the most serious things with people who disagreed with you on some fundamental matters,
exactly,
without just shouting at each other.
Exactly. And this is really the starting point for one of the main questions that I grapple with in this book. Can one take philosophy out of the, you know, traditional academic classroom and somehow make it useful, make it relevant to people who are not trained as academic philosophers?
So you went on and organized a series of philosophy workshops at various hotspots around the world. And the first was at a Palestinian university in East Jerusalem. What did you do there?
Yeah, so I basically organized 5 of these workshops between 2006 and 2011. And so the first, as you mentioned, took place at Al-Quds University, which is the Palestinian university in East Jerusalem. And there I taught a class together with Sari Nusseibeh, who is a prominent Palestinian intellectual and philosopher, and he was also the president of Al-Quds at the time. The idea was to start with texts by Plato and then also go to medieval Muslim and Jewish philosophers who build on Plato and who offer a philosophical interpretation of Islam and Judaism. So they equate Islam and Judaism with religions of reason. And then using these historical texts, these ancient and medieval texts, as a kind of starting point or springboard, we also try to tie the discussion in with the concerns of our students there and the question that arise from the contemporary Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Now, you teach philosophy and Jewish studies. Are you Jewish yourself?
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm.
Was that a stumbling block when you were talking to these Palestinian students?
Yeah, and I didn't feel uncomfortable at any point. You know, part of maybe the benefit of doing this kind of thing is that, you know, once you see, you know, a real Jew in flesh and blood, so to speak, and, you know, he comes there and takes out the Republic and, you know, engages you in a discussion. I think some of these prejudices, I don't think they get dissolved, but I think they at least get called into question, and you can have a dialogue that is really independent of these kind of different religious and in part hostile background that we had. Part of the project also was to show that philosophy offers a kind of set of tools and a language that can cut across various divides, religious divides, political divides, and so forth.
Why would that be the case? I mean, why would philosophy help to sort out some of these questions which are so volatile, especially in a place like Palestine?
Well, you know, I don't think that philosophy can solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but I do think it can make some contributions to it. So we had one very interesting discussion about nonviolent resistance. So Sari Nusseibeh, my co-teacher, he's also a prominent advocate of nonviolent resistance in Palestine, which is not a very popular concept on the ground, right? And understandably so, right? People get hit, they want to hit back. But what Nusseibeh basically argues is that Israelis, somewhat like the British, are enlightened occupiers. If they're faced with nonviolent resistance, most of them will realize that continuing the occupation is not justified. And in addition, this will secure the entire world's sympathy for the Palestinian cause. So he basically argues, for prudential reasons, you should choose nonviolent resistance. We had a very interesting discussion about that when we read Plato's Republic, because one of the key virtues that Plato discusses in the Republic is self-control or moderation. So basically, the question then was if self-control might be a key to solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, precisely because it allows to choose nonviolent resistance rather than out of an impulse of revenge. And so you sort of control yourself, you don't hit back, and you break the cycle of violence, and you actually get what you want more efficiently. And I found this sort of an interesting example where ancient political philosophy and contemporary concerns in the Middle East came together.
And what did the Palestinian students say to this argument?
You know, it got them thinking. Not everyone was convinced. So some people said, why should the Israelis get away with their aggression? You know, why shouldn't we hit back? But, you know, the fact that I can understand this feeling does not mean that acting on it is morally justified.
Yeah. So it sounds like you were putting some challenging questions to these students. I mean, really sort of asking them to question some of their fundamental beliefs. Did they challenge you in any fundamental ways?
Yes, I think so. One of the most surprising things that I learned from these discussions with Egyptian students was that I hadn't properly thought through some of the most fundamental, some of the most basic convictions that I, you know, live by, from my atheism to my ideas about how one should live. Because precisely as I said earlier, these convictions are usually not challenged in the social and academic circles I move in. You know, suddenly I was forced to somehow argue for my view that God doesn't exist, and and I found out how difficult that actually is.
Well, and it sounds like also, I mean, your point was not to, I mean, just as you said the Egyptian students, you know, wanted to convert you to Islam, you weren't necessarily trying to get people to give up their religious belief, but you were trying to figure out how to talk about religion in a way that works for both of you, for both sides.
Right, right. So in a certain way, I try to distinguish my approach from you know, the kind of dialogue between religions that is often practiced. So I think, you know, that we should adopt a somewhat more combative attitude and actually, you know, argue for our beliefs and see what people say back.
So you like argument. I mean, you're not saying we shouldn't argue about this stuff. We should, but we should just do
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
It shouldn't lead to violence. I mean, we should agree to disagree.
That's right, exactly. So this is really the second, I would say, main point of my book, exploring the question if one can use philosophy to ground what I call a culture of debate, so an intellectual space where we can discuss across religious, political, and other boundaries, discuss questions that we deeply disagree on but also deeply care about. I like to kind of propose it as a middle way between war and peace. So we shouldn't gun down someone who disagrees with us or put him in prison. But we should also not get mired in this kind of multicultural complacency where, you know, we pretend that differences don't matter at all or are not a reason for disagreement at all.
Now, one of the ideas you take on has to do with knowledge that's passed down, might be by parents, by teachers, and there's a word for this, taqlid, is that right?
Right, taqlid.
Taqlid.
Yeah, that's the Arabic word.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what does that mean?
It's a word that is not so easy to translate, and I borrow it from the great medieval Muslim theologian Al-Ghazali, who lived in the 10th, early 11th century. He died in 1111. And Al-Ghazali, he left us an intellectual autobiography, which is really very, very interesting. It's an excellent introduction to philosophy. It's called The Deliverance from Error. And he starts that intellectual autobiography with an account of how he, when he was a young man, lost his naive faith, his trust in Islam, namely when he realized that he would have been just as fervent a Jew or Christian as he used to be a Muslim had been brought up in a Jewish or Christian community. And he describes this experience of somehow losing his trust in Islam as a breaking of taqlid. Hmm. And he describes taqlid basically as the authority of parents and teachers. And I think one can broaden that, you know, to all the accidental factors that shape our beliefs without us actually submitting those beliefs to critical scrutiny.
And this is so interesting because that's often the first thing that atheists will say in their critique of religion is, you know, you're only a Christian because your parents were, because you went to a Christian church and you don't know anything else. You're saying that they have a point there, but it's not, it doesn't end there.
Exactly, exactly. You know, I think one of the most interesting things that I took away from my discussion with these Egyptian students in Cairo in 2000 was that I was just as much subject to taqlid as they were, right? So my secular convictions about God not existing and that one should live one's life without somehow betting on some kind of afterlife and so forth, you know, these were convictions that were just as little critically reflected as their convictions about the existence of God and paradise. So, you know, part of the value and the attraction of this culture of debate is precisely that these discussions across culture and religious and other divides, they are sort of a way of breaking the bonds of taqlid, as Al-Ghazali would say. Because I think, you know, obviously we can just sit back in our armchair and start critically reflecting on our beliefs, but I think normally we need some kind of disruptive experience in order to really get thinking. When we meet people who don't share the cultural narratives that we were brought up with and who really challenge us, I think that is an excellent opportunity to get thinking because, you know, then we cannot rely on these narratives. We really have to argue for our views, as I had to with these Egyptian students.
Carlos Frankl teaches philosophy and religion at the University of Montreal. He's the author of Teaching Plato in Palestine. He talked with Steve Paulson. That's it for our show today, but there's more in our podcast feed. To sign up, just visit iTunes or Stitcher or visit our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Craig Ely, Raymond Tangakar, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Until next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.